In ancient times, demons appeared in human mediums, committing adultery with women, abusing boys, and showing people scenes of horror that struck fear into the hearts of those who did not understand these doings. People called these demons gods, and called each of them by one. The citations in this chapter are taken from Weinel's book, Die Wirkungen des Geistes und der Geister im Nachapostolischen Zeitalter bis auf Ioannes, The Workings of the Spirit and the Spirits in the Post-Apostolic Age until Ioannes, published in 1899 by J. C. B. Mohr, Freiburg im Breisgau. Wherever Weinel is quoted, it is from this book. The other sources mentioned are also citations from Weinel's book, too. Weinel, p. 2, here cites Athenagoras Leg. 23, p. 118, 3, Weinel, p. 3, here cites Stat. Or. 22, p. 94. 163. The name the demon assumed. Fear impelled them to do this, for they did not know that these were evil demons. Justin I, 5, 2. Not only had the evil spirits been active in the past, but their doings were witnessed personally every day by the Christians of the early centuries. First of all, there were the various diseases in which a spirit other than the spirit of the patient spoke and acted through him. The maniac had a demon in him. The hysterical and epileptic were possessed. Such was the universal popular belief among Jews, pagans and Christians. These invisible spirit creatures also spoke through human mediums. The Christian writer Tatian thus describes a female medium of Apollo's. After drinking water, she falls into a state of frenzy, incense drives her out of her senses and makes it appear that she is prophesying. Tatian 19, p. 86. A state of frenzy invariably indicates that a low spirit has taken possession of a medium. The presence of good spirits is always accompanied by peace and quiet. The ravings of the priests of Baal as described in the Bible, the frenzied motions of the Bacchantes at the pagan feasts of the Greeks and the Romans, the dancing dervishes of our times, as well as the numerous similar exhibitions given by modern mediums must be ascribed to the influence of evil spirits. These spirit beings could also be seen by the clairvoyants of those times. Persons endowed with the gift of clairvoyance or other mediumistic powers through which they could enter into communication with the spirit world were known back then as pneumaticians, a term derived from the Greek word pneuma, which means spirit. In the present age, which no longer knows anything of the laws of spirit communication, the word pneumatician is interpreted as gifted in spirit, thus creating the impression that it was the spirits of those persons themselves that were the cause of the wondrous phenomena. In reality, however, the pneumaticians were either full-fledged mediums, or persons having a mediumistic talent, or else individuals gifted with the power of clairvoyance or clairaudience. Thus, pneumaticians were not only those who were in touch with the good spirit world, but also persons who were in contact with the evil spirits, the laws governing such communication being the same in both cases. Demons also become visible to people, showing themselves in order to create the belief that they are something proper. Their airy, fiery bodies are easily and often seen, although, to be sure, only by pneumaticians, but the fact that they are seen, and frequently seen, is certain, says Tatian. Horatio ad Gracchos 15, p. 70. 164. The airy and fiery bodies of the demons mentioned above are the odic bodies. All spirits have odic bodies, but their appearance differs according to the sphere each spirit inhabits. It is true also that the idols spoke and performed miracles. Not even the Christians could deny this fact, since it was a matter of general knowledge. It was on this that the heathens based the belief that the idols they worshipped were living spirit creatures and endowed with great powers. They asked, how is it that certain images work miracles, unless the beings to which we erect our statues are deities? It is surely not likely that lifeless, immobile images should develop power by themselves, without someone moving them. To this the Christian, Athenagoras, replies, we Christians do not deny that in certain places, cities and countries, miracles have occurred in the name of the idols, but we do not regard them to be gods. Athenagoras Leg. 23, p. 116, of a statue of a certain Aurelius in Troas, as he relates, it is believed that this statue prophesies and heals the sick. The inhabitants of Troas therefore offer sacrifices to it, and bedeck it with gold and wreaths. It is likewise reported that of the statues of Alexander and Proteus in Parian, the one of Proteus can prophesy, to the other, that of Alexander, offerings and festivals are dedicated at the expense of the state, as to a god who will hear his worshippers. Athenagoras does not deny the phenomena, but he maintains that those who bring them about are evil spirits. Thus people witnessed and experienced the phenomena, and through them received proof of the existence of a mysterious world of spirit beings, beyond the things of this world, spirit beings mightier, wiser, but also more ruthless than people. Beyond and above the Roman Empire there arose the realm of the one who was the true ruler of the world, Zeus, the devil. It was precisely in this Roman Empire, whose governing classes so stubbornly resisted Christianity, that that spirit kingdom seemed to have established its most mighty bulwark. Wynal, p. 1112. The Christians experienced the horrifying workings of the invisible ruler of the world and his instruments on their own persons. What then was the end that the devil and his demons tried to achieve with all their attacks on the Christians? He wanted to lure them away from God, into the era of polytheism, to tear them out of their spiritual lives and to plunge them into spiritual death. For the demons, as they are called, desire only to lead people away from their God and Creator, and from his firstborn, Christ. And those who proved unable to rise above worldly matters they have fettered to man-made objects, statues, and they do so too. 165. This day, Justin 1:58, the demons have accomplished this end by inventing myths and mysteries, thus aping God's plan for the salvation of humanity. They have, by means of their imagery, offered those who sought communion with God a pleasant but soul-destroying substitute for the true revelation. Justin 1:56. The evil spirits that spoke through the idols at the pagan ceremonies produced speech audible to human ears by employing the odd at their disposal to create so-called direct voices. It was, in fact, an imitation of the speech of God through the cloud of odd above the Ark of the Covenant in the tabernacle, for that speech also came as a direct voice, as has been clearly shown in my earlier explanations. Just as during God's speech the required cloud of odd was produced by the blood of the offerings and by the smoke of the sacrificial fires, so the blood of the pagan offerings to the idols and the smoke of their fires were the source of the odd for the direct voices of the evil spirits. In view of the great danger that threatened Christians from the devil and his hosts, there was a very widespread fear of these powers of darkness. It was neither a question of shadows and fantasy images, as it seems to most people in modern times, nor one of tenaciously held unproven doctrines, such as Christians of today have in their denominations. On the contrary, the evil spirits were powers that people experienced daily. They communicated with them and interfered in people's lives at every turn, mysteriously, but potently. Wynal, p. 24. We must picture a Christian, stared at from the walls in the house in which he lived by the Lares and Penates, images of the idols, seemingly threatened by the images in the streets and public squares, passing temples in whose gloomy recesses behind the rows of bright pillars the mysterious powers carried on their work, attracting crowds of people. Among these images were many whose dreadful shapes, with their strangely grotesque combination of human and animal bodies, were appalling. They gave those the creeps who knew that a living, effective, personal spirit power lay behind them. Far more dangerous still were the demons, when they breathed life into softly shimmering marble, when the joyously lovely bodies of the Greek gods and goddesses became the magic that seduced the senses and through which the devil enslaved mankind. Christians realized with horror that all this beauty, full of life, had been stolen from God to be used for sinful purposes, that all the majesty enveloping these deities was a theft of God's grandeur and of his sovereignty over the hearts of men. 166. And when, at family festivities or at municipal or provincial celebrations, Christians experienced in horror the immense power of defection from God, when they saw the foulest crimes of demons and heroes enacted on the stage at such festivals, when the passions of men and gods, like greed, hatred, vindictiveness and sensuality, and their consequences, war, murder, adultery, were displayed with magical seductiveness before the eyes of old and young, mature and immature, then their hearts were stirred by a shudder of contempt and hatred for those who had lured people's souls away from the true God and His eternal goodness and purity through their illusions and bugbears. Fortunate indeed was the Christian who only knew these feelings. For if the beauty of the images and of the people, or the sensual appeal of the spectacles crept into his heart, if man's latent thirst for blood was aroused in him when the gladiators fought, then he could hear, with horror and dismay, these same powers of darkness call to him from the stirrings of his own base instincts, now in the soft tones of flattery, now in wildly seductive tones. He did not only imagine that he heard these voices. The more he listened to them, the deeper he became engrossed in his experiences with the spirit world, the more of a pneumatician he grew to be, the more clearly and frequently he would hear these voices. Indeed, he would actually see the forms of the evil spirits and experience the physical torments of their 4. Presence. If, in spite of all, he remained true to his God, the very worst might yet be in store for him. In a time of persecution, Satan and his minions developed their greatest strength. With abhorrence and dread the Christian came to know the cruelty of these mighty and ruthless enemies, either through the suffering of his friends or the torturous pain that racked his own tormented body. Wynal, pages 24-25. What then was the power that enabled the Christians to overcome the evil spirit powers? They themselves have given us the answer. It is a Holy Spirit, a Spirit of God, that gives us the power. The spirits of God came to them as they had come to the earlier Christian congregations. Thus Justin, speaking of the Christians of his own day, says, "They receive gifts, each according to his merit, and are enlightened in the name of this Christ. One may receive a spirit of insight, another a spirit of counsel, a third a spirit of strength, still others receive spirits of healing, of foreknowledge, of teaching or of piety." Justin, Dialogue 39, p. 132, "There are among us men and 4, Wynal, p. 25, here cites that, or 15, p. 70. 167. Women upon whom a Spirit of God has bestowed gifts of grace. Justin, Dialogue 88, p. 318. In his dialogue with Tryphon the Jew, Justin says, "The gifts of prophecy still exist among us, whereby you may see that the things formerly given to your lineage have now descended on us. And just as there were false prophets in the days when the holy prophets appeared among you, so there are false teachers among us today." Justin, Dialogue 82, p. 296. Those who wanted to expel communication with God's spirits from the religion are taken to task by Irenaeus, who speaks from the standpoint of the entire Christian church of his time when he says of the sect of the Elogians, "They destroy the gift of the Spirit that has been poured out to all of mankind in the latter days according to God's will. They do not want to admit that form of evangelism described in the Gospel of John, where the Lord promised to send us the spirit world. And they reject not only the Gospel, but also the spirit of prophecy." The term latter days used by Irenaeus was understood by the Christians to mean the time from the appearance of Christ until the end of the world. By spirit of prophecy the Christians understood a spirit that communicated God's truth to mankind through a human medium, as was the rule in the early Christian congregations. According to early Christian doctrine, the truth could be learned only from God's spirits. This doctrine was expressed in the maxim, "The truth must be learned where God's gifts of grace are to be found." Inasmuch as communication with the good spirit world was, and still is, governed by the same laws as communication with evil spirits, the teachings of both spirit worlds are outwardly similar, and only from the content of the messages and from the behavior of the spirit beings that have entered the human mediums can we judge whether these messages come from good or evil, from high or low spirit beings. As for the messages themselves, In those days, Jews, pagans, and Christians, Catholic and non-Catholic, all regarded them as communication from invisible spirit beings. Whenever a Christian sees a vision of an angel or a demon, of Christ or of the devil, whenever a Christian or a pagan or a Gnostic has a vision, it is not true, as many modern theologians claim, that what in the case of the Christian is a real experience, is merely hallucination in that of a Jew, since in each of these cases invisible, superhuman spirit beings actually revealed themselves for that space of time. And these visions may occur in the same manner each time. Weinel, p. 64. 168. The activities of the Holy Spirits and those of the demons, however, do not only bear a general resemblance to each other, but one and the same phenomenon may be construed as the work of either a good or an evil spirit, according to the dogmatic, religious, standpoint of the author. What might be considered the work of good and holy spirits by a member of the Christian sect of the Gnostics, might appear to a Catholic as an hallucination produced by demons, and vice versa. Weinel, p. 64. Whenever pneumatic manifestations appear in the same spiritual and physical domain, their similarity across the centuries is most striking. The monastic mystic of the Middle Ages, the Quaker in Protestant England, the inspired Huguenot, the faith healer of the 19th century, all experience and behave precisely as did the pneumaticians of the Church in its formative stage. Weinel, p. 65. According to Christian doctrine, there are no neutral effects in the field of pneumatic, mediumistic, phenomena. Either the spirit at work is good or evil. Weinel, p. 67. The methods by which spirits communicated in post-apostolic times were the same as those described in the earlier chapters on mediums in this book. The spirits did their speaking through mediums. There were parashtrans mediums, whose own spirit hears whatever the foreign spirit says through the medium, as well as deep trance mediums, through whom a foreign spirit spoke while the medium himself was quite unconscious. A medium who spoke in a partial trance thus describes his sensations: "On these occasions I always felt myself being uplifted to God, in whose name I therefore solemnly declare that I have never been bribed or enticed by anyone, or influenced by any worldly considerations whatever, to speak any words other than those which God's spirit or angel itself utters through my organs of speech. To such a spirit I therefore yield the guidance of my tongue during my state of ecstasy, meanwhile using all my effort to direct my spirit toward God and to remember the words pronounced by my lips. I know that a higher and different power is speaking through me then. I do not think about it and have no idea beforehand of what I will say. It thus seems to me as if my own words are being spoken by someone else, but they leave a deep impression on my spirit." Weinel, p. 77-78. Often, also, a spirit prays through a medium who is in a partial trance. An example of such a prayer in spirit is strikingly presented in the martyrdom of Polycarp. The sensation of being deeply moved is also aptly described here. 169. Polycarp comes down from the upper story of the house where he had been hidden for safety to the soldiers waiting below, orders his servants to provide food for the soldiers, of whom he requests an hour's undisturbed respite for prayer. When this was granted, he stood before them and, filled with the grace of God, in spirit, prayed so fervently that for 2 hours he could not cease, and all of his hearers were seized with fear, while many of them regretted having come to take prisoner an old man so highly favored by God. He could not cease, for it was not he himself that was speaking, but something else spoke from within him and would not allow him to stop. Meanwhile, he is not aware of anything that is going on around him. He is utterly unaffected by exhaustion, which would ordinarily have made it impossible for a man of his age to remain standing so long. Everyone present realized that it was not Polycarp himself who spoke, but that someone else was speaking through him. A sight like this is always unnerving to those who witness it, and this is generally true whenever the spirit world from the beyond comes into contact with people in a manner perceptible to the human senses, but especially so for those who witness it for the first time. Undoubtedly the Swabai and clergyman Blumhardt, at whose praying the sick felt the spirits of disease leave them, was someone who prayed like Polycarp. Weinel, p. 83. The state of deep trance, or actual ecstasy, was very prevalent among the mediums of the Montanists. Eusebius, Montanus' opponent, says that it was reported to him that the recently baptized Montanus, motivated by boundless ambition, allowed the evil enemy to enter his soul. He was filled with a spirit and, having suddenly been possessed and fallen into ecstasy, began to speak in a state of great emotion, uttering foreign-sounding words. Similarly, two women aroused by him spoke, while unconscious, quite suddenly and strangely like Montanus, filled with the same evil spirit. The spirit speaking through Montanus explains this mediumistic state in the following words: "Behold, man is like a lyre, a musical instrument, and I fly to him like a plectrum, with which that instrument is played." This describes accurately the relationship in which a spirit stands to the medium through whom it speaks. The medium is merely the instrument in the hands of the spirit. He is the piano and the foreign spirit is the piano player. This is so of all true mediums, without exception. The condemnation expressed by Eusebius in the foregoing sentences of the spirit influences at work in the religious congregation of the Montanists, who were, after all, Christians like himself, is the judgment of a 170. Religious opponent, and it must be remembered that of all enemies, the bitterest are religious ones. Religious opponents of all times have made the freest use of the weapons of lies and slander and distortion of the truth. That spirit communication among the Montanists could not have been of the nature imputed to them by their Catholic opponents is obvious from the fact that Tertullian, the most learned and serious church teacher of the time, went over from the Catholic congregation to the Montanists. Whoever is familiar with the works of this church teacher will understand at once that the spirit manifestations that occurred among the Montanists must have been of a serious and sacred nature, otherwise this man would never have joined that congregation. Inasmuch as the spirit workings among the Montanists attracted great attention among the Christians and did serious harm to the recognized Christian church known as the Catholic, the leaders of the Catholic Church at that time promptly proclaimed the dogma that no true instrument of God speaks while in ecstasy, that is to say, in a deep trance. They did this in spite of the fact that it was generally known that there had been many people in all ages who had spoken as instruments of God while in a state of ecstasy. Thus Athenagoras, Catholic though he was, who lived during those times, says, "The prophets, while they were in a state of ecstatic unconsciousness and their activities were controlled by a divine spirit, have uttered things instilled into them, a holy spirit breathing through them as a flutist plays his flute." Athenagoras, Legatio 9, p. 42. Elsewhere Athenagoras repeats that the spirits have caused the prophets' organs of speech to function as though they were instruments. In the Justinian Oratio ad Gracchos we read, "The heaven-sent divine plectrum played the righteous as it would a musical instrument, a zither or a lyre." Justin and Theophilus make use of the same images, saying the same thing as the spirit that spoke out of Montanus. Among the Montanists the methods of spirit communication were the same as those practiced by the earliest Christian communities. The book entitled The Shepherd of Hermas, a spiritistic work through and through, was so highly regarded in post-apostolic days as to be added to the Holy Scriptures. This book also explains in detail how to distinguish the speaking mediums of good spirits from those of the evil ones. From what is said there it is clear that the spirit from on high and the terrestrial spirit cannot be distinguished by their manner of speaking. Apart from the content of what is said, Hermas identifies the following features as characteristic of the speech of good spirits through a medium: no divinely sent spirit will submit to being questioned. That is, such a spirit will not allow itself to be used as an oracle, to satisfy human curiosity, naturally. 171. People may ask questions of a spirit, if they have failed to understand its message or if they remain in doubt as to some point or other contained therein. The good spirit world even demands this of its hearers, for it imparts its messages, teachings, and admonitions for their benefit and earnestly desires that its words be thoroughly understood and correctly construed. Hence it welcomes any necessary questions. The spirits often invite their hearers to ask questions, even such as may have no bearing on the immediate subject of the communication. This happens in those cases in which a spirit knows that there is someone present who wants to ask a question, which, however, must never pertain to purely material issues. A second mark that distinguishes the presence of a good spirit in a medium is, it is not for human beings to determine whether and when a spirit shall speak. A spirit speaks only when God wants it to speak. In all communication with good spirits, it is therefore impossible to put a medium in trance for the sake of obtaining a spirit message. It comes when it is meant to come. People cannot make it come. People can, indeed, create the conditions required for spirit communication by making available the necessary odic force, but whether or not communication will follow does not depend on them. The process is described by Hermes as follows: the angel of the attending prophetic spirit fills a person, and that person, filled with the Holy Spirit, speaks to the congregation as the Lord wills. The deep trance state of the montanist mediums, and this occurs with all deep trance mediums, is described with the words, they bow their faces to the ground. This appears to refer to the onset of the deep trance, for, as the medium's own spirit leaves the body, that body sinks over forward and is returned to an erect posture only when the foreign spirit enters it. The stepping out or departure of the medium's spirit is accurately expressed by the word ecstasy, the meaning of which is a stepping out. After the foreign spirit enters, the communication proceeds in complete calm, if that spirit is a good one. If, however, an evil spirit has taken possession of the medium, conditions very often arise that give even observers inexperienced in such matters the impression of demonic possession. As the Christian Tatian says, raving is the work of demons. Clairvoyance, clairaudience and clairsentience, which includes the senses of taste and smell, also occurred frequently among the Christians of the first few centuries. Much space in the Book of Hermes is devoted to clairvoyance and clairaudience, for most of the communications received by him came. 172. Through these channels, a female figure that he saw and heard explained the truths of the beyond to him. She is his guide, as Beatrice was to the clairvoyant Dante, for Dante also saw most of what he wrote down in his Divine Comedy through clairvoyance. The martyr Polycarp also foresaw his destined death by clairvoyance. He spent his time at the country home to which he had fled with a handful of companions, doing nothing day and night but praying for everyone and for the congregations of the whole world, as he was in the habit of doing. 3 days before his capture, while he was at prayer, he had a vision in which he saw his pillow in flames. At this, he turned to those around him and said, "God has determined that I am to be burned alive." The most frequent visions granted to clairvoyant believers in God are figures and landscapes in the beyond, and, generally, visions of the spirit realm as a world similar to ours on earth, only spiritual instead of material. Needless to add, pagan clairvoyants had similar visions, for clairvoyance is a gift of the human spirit resulting from the configuration of the odds surrounding it, enabling it to see in the same manner as a disembodied spirit. The things seen by a clairvoyant are as faithful an image as are the images of the material world seen by our physical eyes. The spirit world can show these images to a clairvoyant whenever it pleases. Odd is the substance of which they are composed. It depends entirely on the inner attitude of the clairvoyant whether his visions of the beyond are presented by the good or evil spirit world. Clairvoyance relating to things on earth and dependent on odic radiations of terrestrial beings is not affected by the clairvoyant's inner attitude, and for this reason the pagan clairvoyants were able to foretell events on earth quite as well as the Christian clairvoyants, although the Christians claimed that demons were producing the pagans' visions. The records of the early centuries of the Christian era are filled with such instances of clairvoyance and clairaudience. When Polycarp died a martyr's death in Smyrna, Irenaeus, who happened to be in Rome at the time, heard a trumpet-like voice proclaim, "Polycarp has become a martyr." As regards mediumistic writing, Many leading Christians of the time assert that they were inspired by the spirit world in their writing. The development of mediums in the post-apostolic age was the same as in the first Christian congregations, taking place at the gatherings for divine service. According to Hermas, a prophet would enter the pneumatic state while the congregation prayed together, all of those present joining hands to symbolize unity. The closed circuit of odic current thus formed furnished the spirit world with the material it needed for